I found the first crime on a cold January night in 2013.
Well, Dwight Eisenhower had deception in his bones.
Charlie Fields of the Chanute Black Diamonds jumped into the chest-deep water to retrieve the ball and threw out a runner at home trying to score from first base.
The streets in town were named after states in order of when they'd been admitted to the Union. It seemed a betrayal to Cliff.
When the tornado came and swept you away as you knew all along it would, it was not to drop you into some technicolor fantasy.
Today on KPR Presents, books, books, and more books. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the 2018 Kansas Notable Books, Part 2. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. We'll hear from several of the Kansas Notable authors on today's program. We'll also learn about public television's The Great American Read, the search for America's 100 best-loved novels, and how you can participate. That's in the second half of today's KPR Presents. If you missed my previous KPR Presents, Kansas Notable Books Part 1, featuring interviews with many of this year's Kansas Notable authors, you can find it on our website, kansaspublicradio.org, under news/KPR Presents. The Kansas Notable authors were honored September 8th at the Kansas Book Festival in Topeka. While at the book festival, I had a chance to visit with some of the other Kansas Notable authors, including Mark Eberle of Hays. His Kansas Notable book is Kansas Baseball, 1858 to 1941.
1858 was the first record we have in newspapers of the word baseball being mentioned in the state. And so it wasn't an organized game. It was just some people out playing in Emporia on Christmas Day. And so that was kind of the reason for the beginning. And then 1941 was, of course, the year that World War II began. And so all the WPA projects that were building baseball stadiums and all the players were being diverted to other things. And so there was kind of a lull in baseball activity, except for some company and military teams that were playing to kind of have something to do during their long days of training and work in the factories and those sorts of things. So it was kind of a nice break point. And then everything changed after World War II, because before that, everything was segregated. And after World War II, Jackie Robinson came on the scene, and so baseball became an integrated game gradually. It didn't happen overnight. And so it was just kind of a nice, easy break point.
You've written several books before, many about fish.
Yeah, I'm a biologist by training.
This is a bit of a departure. Tell me about your interest in baseball.
It is a little bit, but the two things, right, if you're going to do something in the summer outside, it's fish or baseball, right? You're not going to do football. You're not going to go pheasant hunting. You're going to go fishing. And so there is some connection, I guess, between those. And so baseball is just one of those sports. It's something people grow up with sometimes in the summers. Not everyone's a baseball fan, but it's one of those kinds of activities that if you get it when you're a little kid, it just never really leaves you. You never really quite grow up, right? All the major league teams, they're not populated by men. Those are the boys of summer, not the men of summer kind of thing. So,
baseball historian Dorothy Seymour described your book as being dizzyingly thorough. Talk to me. That seems like a mixed phrase.
It's the biology part. It's a lot of baseball histories don't have a lot of documentation, so there are a lot of myths floating around. And so I probably got a little carried away, and the book is like one quarter, here's every place I got my information kind of documentation. And that's not that I went into this trying to tear down myths, because myths are fun, but sometimes myths get believed as fact. And so I just wanted to say, enjoy it as a myth, but don't take it as fact.
Getting back to your dizzyingly thorough research, how did you go about researching baseball for this book?
Most of it comes from contemporary newspapers. And not relying too much on secondary sources, unless it was just kind of like a background sort of statement. But was just reading all the many, every town had multiple newspapers, it seems like, at that time. And so sometimes they competed for how they would describe events in their community, including baseball games. And so there's a lot of information in there. And the towns were using their teams as a means of boosting themselves. They were competing against nearby towns for, you know, who was going to dominate, who was going to be the county seat and maintain that. And so there was a lot of talk about baseball in all those newspapers. And so it provided a lot of interesting information and not written by sports writers. So some of the descriptions they're fun to read.
It's what would happen if I were to write a baseball story, yeah. I suspect.
But it's fun. Yeah.
One of the things I found really interesting about your book was the extent to which baseball really shaped the social life in a lot of Kansas towns, or how the social life was really, it really revolved around baseball.
It did, because, you know, in this era, radio was just starting to come in. There was obviously no TV, no computers, a lot of people, there were no vehicles other than those drawn by horses or powered by steam. And so it was, everybody kind of got there on foot, maybe horse wagon or something of that nature. And so it was just a way when you had those longer days. So you spend, you know, it wasn't a 40-hour work week back then either. It was a six days a week. You went maybe 10 hours of work, but now you had that extra sunlight. And so it was a chance to be outside socializing with everybody else in the community. Even if you were living on a farm, you came into town. And so it was just something that let's all go down and hang out in the grandstand and watch somebody play baseball or those sorts of things. So it was almost like a county fair, but you could do it every week or even several times a week.
You really delve into how baseball teams really formed around racial and ethnic divisions and how much that played into those communities really having something to be proud of and rallying around.
Yeah, and so a lot of the smaller towns, you know, had actually integrated teams, the town team. It wasn't professional, and so they were willing to forego the segregation that might have occurred elsewhere in the community, but to do it, you wanted the best baseball team, and it didn't matter after that. And so, but in the cities got larger, then the segregation became a little more rigid. But each of those communities within the larger city, you know, because those were the people interacting with each other on a regular basis anyway. So it's kind of like a town within a town. And so a lot of those teams were still representing a community. It was just part of the larger city.
About half of your book, Kansas Baseball, is about the baseball teams and the baseball players. But then you switch gears pretty drastically and talk about the baseball stadiums themselves.
Yeah, that was actually, this whole thing's a big accident. And so I like to go visit old places. I'm a biologist, but I have a passion for history. But I'm one of those people, too, that believes you have to go to the place where the history happened to really kind of immerse yourself a little bit more. And so kind of merging those two, I went to baseball parks and was just kind of curious as to, I wonder where the oldest one is in the state, because you hear about Boston's Fenway Park and Chicago's Wrigley Field being the oldest ones in the major leagues. It's like, well, what does Kansas have? And so I just kind of started looking into it for fun. And then as I started talking to people, they kept asking other questions and I didn't know the answer to those questions. And so it just kind of snowballed eventually. And so my hope was in part that, I mean, if I can tell the story of the people at the front end of the book and then kind of tell the story of these places where you can still experience something that the people that lived there in the 1920s or 1890s might have experienced in that same place, that it would give those communities, those few that still have those really old baseball parks, a reason to conserve it the same way they might conserve an old historical church or a historical business building or something of that nature. So,
in your research, did you discover a favorite baseball stand?
Oh, now you're going to get me in trouble. Yes. Yeah, I mean, when I started, there were 10 built before World War II. One of those was torn down while I was working on the book, the one in Independence, Kansas, and the one in Wichita is now slated for demolition this winter. So we'll be down to 8 that were built before World War II. But out of those, they're all really nice. And so the communities have done a good job of continuing to use them for what they're supposed to be used for, baseball and even some other activities. But Junction City is my favorite one.
Why is that?
Because it has all the elements I like in a baseball park. It's got native stone on the outside, which gives it kind of a nice character, a kind of a permanence sort of look. The old ballparks were all sometimes just all wood, and they'd burn down, and you'd have to build it every 5 or 10 years because the other one had burned down. So this gives it a look of permanence, but once you get on the inside, the seating is all still wood. It's got a wooden roof over the top. And so they've done a really nice job of restoring it here a few years ago. And so it's got that look of permanence, but it's still got that old time feel that a baseball park should have if you're just going there for baseball. A lot of the modern ballparks are as much sports bar as they are baseball park. And so if you just really want to go watch baseball, that's the kind of park I would go to.
Tell me about a favorite team or player or episode that you learned about while you were researching your book.
Oh, I don't know. There's kind of a lot of those. It was just interesting, not so much that there was like that outstanding person, because a lot of people think of the famous people that maybe were born in Kansas that played baseball. Walter Johnson, for example, from down in southeast Kansas, is one of the best pitchers ever. One of the first 5 people chosen for the Baseball Hall of Fame in New York. And there were some other players. But it was the fact that everybody was doing it. And so it wasn't so much a single person, but communities were doing it that I didn't really fully appreciate going into that. I was used to just thinking in terms of individual people or maybe even just an individual team, but it was like everywhere. Towns that don't exist anymore had a baseball team back then. And so that, how pervasive it was through all these communities during the summers was the thing that I really enjoyed the most, was just reading all of that. And the perseverance that people played. Some people, just women in particular, and it's the one area where we haven't fully integrated yet, maybe someday, but women's teams were abused worse than any others. They were scoffed at in the news media. They were scoffed at by the locals. And so for any of them to go out and play baseball, they really had to want to do that. And so their perseverance in the face of all of that criticism, I always kind of respected that. And it was true for other groups as well, but women probably more so than the rest.
Mark, can I have you read an excerpt from your book?
Okay, and so this is kind of going back to baseball parks, right? The whole thing that started this process. And we kind of have a view now of all these nice contained parks with big fences, so you have to pay to get in and see. But the baseball parks were not always quite so standardized in that fashion. So this is about a couple of incidents that occurred in Chanute down in southeastern Kansas. The absence of an outfield fence and constraining ground rules at many early baseball grounds meant that a home run could be achieved on a batter's speed around the bases, or perhaps when a well-hit ball went rolling into a cornfield. In Chanute, with one man on base, Claude Spofford drove the ball into the alfalfa between deep center and right. Spofford ramped around the bases for all he was worth, and after denting the pan, walked over to the bench with a broad smile, expecting to receive congratulations. Instead, manager L.R. Summers remarked, "That did not look like a bunt to me. You are fined the price of a smoke for not sacrificing when you were told to." It was not only outfields bordered by crops that presented a challenge for fielders. There was a lagoon near a baseball diamond in Chanute. During a game in 1904, the ball was hit into the lagoon and remained in play. Charlie Fields of the Chanute Black Diamonds, an African-American team, jumped into the chest-deep water to retrieve the ball and threw out a runner at home trying to score from first base.
That's Mark Eberle reading from his book, Kansas Baseball, 1858 to 1941. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us today on KPR Presents, it's the 2018 Kansas Notable Books, Part 2. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as the best new books by Kansas authors or about Kansas. If you missed Part 1 of my 2018 Kansas Notable Book Show, it's now archived at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Becky Mandelbaum now lives in Washington State, but grew up in Kansas. Her collection of short stories is called Bad Kansas.
I feel like it's more about bad relationships that just happen to happen in Kansas than anything about Kansas necessarily. So yeah, I think I was writing this book at a time when I was, you know, leaving a lot of friends. And I had just ended a relationship that was really important to me and moving away from family. So I think I was just really thinking about the ways that people split apart or come together and how location can play into that. Yeah, it's funny because when I was in the middle of writing this, this was my graduate thesis, and right before I had to defend my thesis, a visiting professor where I went to grad school, she asked me what the stories were about, and I kind of froze because I hadn't been tasked with really coming up with anything like that yet, and I was just paralyzed until I realized it was about terrible men in Kansas, pretty much.
That's a good description. Like I said, it seemed to me like just one uncomfortable relationship after another. Weaving through all of those stories, though, is Kansas. Talk to me about the sense of place that you evoke in your stories.
Yeah. Like I said, I wrote this right after moving from Kansas. Some of them I started while I was actually still living in Lawrence, on the brink of leaving. I think two or three of the stories in here I started the year after I graduated from KU. And then the rest I wrote when I was in graduate school in California, really homesick for Kansas. So I think Kansas was just on my mind, and it was the only place I'd ever known. And yeah, I was just like obsessively thinking about it and talking about it with people from California. And I just kind of, you know, when I sat down to write my stories in grad school, they're, you know, I didn't know where else to place them other than home. And yeah, I was just sort of thinking about it a lot at that point in my life.
One of your stories is about a young woman who travels from Kansas out to California, and she's so uncomfortable there. And at one point, a friend she meets says, "Oh, of course, you're homesick." And she says, "No, it's not that I'm homesick. It's just I'm not Californian."
Yeah, that sums up my feelings of moving to California expertly. It was strange being in California because everyone in California is so obsessed with California. They're like, "Oh, welcome to paradise. You're from Kansas. You're going to love it here." And, you know, I talked about Kansas all the time to my California friends, and they were like, "Oh, you're homesick. You're homesick." And I was so resistant to that. I was like, "No, I'm not for Kansas. Like, I am in California." And then I realized it wasn't just that I didn't like California. It's that I was missing home a lot. Mm.
Talk to me about the story, The House on Alabama Street. It's a story set in Lawrence, again, on the tales of a failed relationship.
Yeah. So that story had its origins. One of my friends in graduate school, his name was Jacob, and I joked at the beginning of school that he would tell me all these like weird stories from his life, and I joked that I was going to write all of my stories about him in some capacity. And so he was living in this house with this woman who had just gotten divorced, and she was middle-aged, and he would talk about how she would, you know, corner him and talk to him late at night. And I just developed this whole imaginary scenario in which she was trying to seduce him because she was lonely. So that story, it's a blend of that. And right before graduate school, I worked in Grand Teton National Park. And I met a guy out there, and it was just a total summer park seasonal work fling. And I just kept thinking, he was like, "Oh, maybe I could come, you know, and live with you in California when you're in grad school." And I was like, that is just, you know.
Maybe not.
Yeah, so that story sort of was a blend of those situations playing out.
Can I get you to read an excerpt from that story?
Okay. "The streets in town were named after states, in order of when they'd been admitted to the Union. It seemed a betrayal to Cliff, as if the town's residents secretly dreamed of living somewhere other than Kansas, a desolate state filled with desolate people."
Is that how you found Lawrence? Because elsewhere in your writing, I believe that it's Cliff that says, the people here do seem nice.
Yeah. I just try to, in that story, I was trying to kind of embody some of the reactions to Kansas that I'd been encountering in my friends in California. And I think it would be hard for someone not from Kansas to come here and not see the magic right away. So that was sort of what I was playing with him.
How are the stories in Bad Kansas like or unlike other writing that you've done?
Yeah, I was just talking to someone about this. These stories are, a lot of them have been workshopped and revised over and over and over again and really kind of tailored down. And a lot of my work outside of these stories is, I think, quirkier, or some of them have a magical element, or they're more humor-based. I feel like I get more experimental than these stories are. These stories feel very neat and tidy in a way that some of my stuff outside of them doesn't.
Talk to me about writing in the short story form. Why does that work for you?
I love short stories because you can focus on the sentence level. And every word, you know, you can just get so obsessive about a word and an image, or just the way, you know, a sentence flows into the next one. And I'm working on a novel right now, and that it's hard because that obsession just makes everything so slow and meticulous. And yeah, in a short story, that you know you have to do it because every sentence is so important. Whereas in a novel, you know, there's so much material to work with that it's more about, you know, narrative drive and making sure that the whole thing sort of sticks together. Whereas the story, you know, it's just like this tiny little delicate chocolate that you get to mess with rather than this big tiered cake.
Tell me about the title Bad Kansas. Any fears that it's discouraging Kansans from picking up the book?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a very strong reaction to it. Some people really like it, and other people are like, oh, it's not about Kansas being bad necessarily. But I like the punchiness to it. A friend of mine actually came up with it, and then it kind of stuck in my head.
I think it's a great title.
Thanks.
Because you know from the beginning, these are not going to be happy little stories that are tied up with a ribbon.
Yeah. I wanted them to kind of share the experience of Kansas that I've had, where everything isn't, you know, polite and vanilla. It's very gritty and quirky and, yeah, strange.
With that in mind, and I realize that you're not responsible for the book cover, talk to me about the jacket, because I feel like that, it's so arresting.
Yeah, it's very weird. I wrote them, so University of Georgia Press asked me what kind of cover I had in mind, or if I had anything I was thinking of, and I sent them like this long, like, two-page explanation of like, oh, you know, I want it to be kind of weird, but I want it to have something to do with, you know, the prairie and the openness of Kansas, but have strange, like a strange element within. And they kind of nailed it on the head. It wasn't what I was imagining at all, but then again, I have no idea what I was imagining.
So describe it for our listeners.
I like to think of it as sort of the view from inside of a car, and you're driving down a country road somewhere in Kansas, probably more towards the middle or western side because it's pretty flat, and there's a blue sky, and then there is just a very large grasshopper sort of clinging to the windshield, and he's got some pretty striking and feet and antennas, so I think he's pretty cute.
I think it's pretty disturbing, but again, that kind of captures the whole quirkiness of this book and the kind of unsettled feel of a lot of your stories.
Yeah, I came up with a whole metaphorical explanation of someone looking out onto the prairie, and then there's this, like, graphic, disturbing thing sort of hitting them in the nose.
Becky, can I have you read another excerpt from your book, Bad Kansas?
Yes, sure. I'm going to read from a story called Bald Bear. It's the last story in the book, and I'm just going to read from the beginning. And this was actually one of the stories that I started when I was still living in Lawrence. It was understood that Maxine and I were waiting for men. It was the dead center of July, and the Kansas sun was poised like the face of a hammer, ready to strike. In the lake, diapers surfaced jellyfish style, and children, war-painted with sunscreen, pressed bottle caps to their ears, listening for an ocean they'd likely never seen. Maxine and I started rubbing sunscreen onto each other. There was nothing sorority girl about it. For the type of girls we were, both from hardy Irish stock, our bodies like two peeled potatoes, the application of sunscreen was more of a medical procedure than anything else. Maxine was working on my shoulders when a pair of men appeared before us, one holding a fishing pole, the other a hot dog. We were familiar with their kind, late 20-somethings who wore cutoffs and toted red Playmate coolers filled with hams. They came to the lake to drink and fish and sneak glances at girls in bikinis. The fisherman's fly was down, and he was severely sunburned on his cheeks and nose, as if someone had taken a frying pan to his face. The hot dog eater was better, tall and tanned with a lumberjack beard. He was attractive, genuinely attractive, and seemed completely unaware of it. "How we doing, ladies?" the fisherman asked, speaking through a cheek of chew. Either something blew into the hot dog eater's eye, or he winked at me. "Perfectly fine," I said, half wanting them to go away. I could foresee the whole thing. The hot dog eater would go for Maxine, who was objectively prettier and funnier than me, and I'd be stuck with the fisherman. "Can we help you?" "We just wanted to come by and invite you to a barbecue," the fisherman said. He tilted his head toward the parking lot, where a group of people were gathered around a charcoal grill. I was hungry and bored and had a deep love for barbecues, but I wasn't about to accept an invitation from strangers. Luckily, Maxine had an inherent affection for strangers, yet another quality that drew men to her. She once drove all the way to Aspen with a guy she met in a yoga class. She invited me along, but I told her we'd both end up dead in a ditch. As it turned out, the guy was related to a famous screenwriter, and the three of them, Maxine, the guy, the screenwriter, spent the weekend drinking cognac in an outdoor hot tub. She hadn't even had to kiss anyone. "Actually, I'm starving," Maxine told the fisherman, and began to gather her things. She looked at me, eyebrows raised. "You coming?" Not wanting to be alone, I put on most of my clothes and followed her to the parking lot.
That's Becky Mandelbaum reading from Bad Kansas. Becky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kansas Public Radio has a copy of Bad Kansas to give away, as well as several other Kansas notable books. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, go to our website, kansaspublicradio.org, and look under Available Giveaways. You can also leave a comment on KPR's Facebook page under this week's KPR Presents post. My next Kansas notable author is Robert Rabin. His collection of essays is called Headlights on the Prairie, Essays on Home. Robert, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You live in Indianapolis, but your writing just smacks of Kansas. It is so, I don't want to use the term homespun, but it really evokes Kansas of a certain era. Talk to me about your sense of place and why your stories are so rooted in Kansas.
Well, maybe part of it is that I'm not, when I write, I'm really not trying to project the mythic Kansas or the Kansas that everyone on the two coasts thinks exists. I try to write about Kansas rooted in detail and in actual stories. So I grew up in Dodge City in western Kansas in a very distinct milieu with people who really stand out in my memory. And even though I've lived in Indiana for 20 years, my family and I, we come back at least 2 times a year, and I come back more like 4 times a year.
One common thread throughout your stories is there's a lot of tension between western Kansas as home and western Kansas as a place you visit.
Well, you know, I really didn't think much about Kansas as a place or myself as someone who is from here until I left. And then, I've lived away from Kansas pretty much since 1984. And And I missed it a lot, but also I just found that a big part of my identity was caught up with Kansas and being from Kansas, and specifically growing up with a father who was in agriculture and farming and ranching. And so from being away for a long time made me realize what Kansas really was all about. And so as a writer, you know, we often say that to get the true sense of place and to really communicate it to readers, you need to not only be an insider to the place, to have insider knowledge of the place, but you need to live away far enough and long enough that you develop kind of an outsider's view of it. You begin to see what's unique and interesting about it because you know how it differs from other places.
One of my favorite stories in your collection, Headlights on the Prairie, is one in which you talk about a bully in junior high who sets his sights on you and how you figure out how to deal with that. Can you talk to me about that story?
Yeah, I guess if it falls into a particular genre, it is a bully story. It's also a story about being new to a place. So when I was in school, I went to Catholic school grades 1 through 8. And then at that time, junior high was 7th, 8th, and 9th. So all of us who went to the Catholic school, we went through 8th grade. And then for 1 year, we went to the junior high and just kind of messed up the whole chemistry for 1 year. And then the next year, all of us went off to high school. So there was a lot of tension and there was a lot of, bumping of horns. And in the story you're talking about, yeah, I am challenged by the bully. He had asked someone, well, who's the toughest kid or who's the fighter coming from Sacred Heart? And someone said it was me. And so he got my name and he thought, well, we have to figure this thing out. So I was really, really surprised. But I'm glad you feel like it's full of a lot of tension, because even though it is a story about a fight, only one punch is thrown in the entire story.
I remember those junior high days, and my own junior high had a pair of girls who were twins who the school would probably once every 3 months just be shaken by these rumors that the Leonard twins had set their sights on someone and that someone was going to get beat up. I don't know that it actually ever happened, but that kind of fight for territory, that just seems like it's a universal theme at that age.
Well, that you had twice the trouble. That's like a bully times two.
Yeah. Robert, can I have you read from one of your stories?
Yeah, sure. I'll read just a little bit from the first chapter, and this is the shortest chapter in the book, and it's, I don't know that it's a representative chapter because most of the chapters have a lot of dramatization and a lot of scene. But in this chapter, I focus a little bit more on themes, some of the themes of the book. So this chapter is called Why I Hate the Wizard of Oz. Imagine having the land of your birth, a place about which you have complex and wildly ambivalent feelings, reduced to a black and white cartoon. Someone asks you where you're from, and when you reply, Kansas, this well-meaning stranger grins and blurts out, "Where's Toto?" "Oh, that's right. We're not in Kansas anymore." You get this in New York, Indiana, California, even as far afield as Paris, France, you get it. Kansas, ah oui, les munchkins. How to say that you hail from a place uninhabited by 10 men and sweet little girls in pinafores, a demanding, starkly beautiful place with 20-mile views, sunflowers as big as your head, and night skies so clear that you might believe yourself to have been born among stars. Where the wind blows without cease and flies bite like vampires, and the stink of the slaughterhouse overhangs everything like a toxic cloud. Where it's not unusual for a kid like you to receive his first shotgun at 10, drive a wheat truck at 12, and solo in a Beechcraft Debonair at 14 or 15. Does that sound like Oz, you want to ask? But you don't. Why bother? When the tornado came and swept you away as you knew all along it would, it was not to drop you into some technicolor fantasy, rather into the same world of Applebee's and Best Buy the jokesters inhabit. That's the context here. That's the reason you refuse to join Dorothy's fan club.
That's Robert Rabine reading from his book, Headlights on the Prairie, Essays on Home. Robert, one of the things I love about your writing is it seems deceptively simple. You have a very straightforward writing style, and it's easy to read your stories and think, I could have written that. And yet you capture this sense of place and that time in your life so beautifully and so effortlessly. Perhaps it's not so effortless.
Well, I have to say, you know, writing is a mixture of really hard work, but there's a lot of joy involved in it too. And I have to say that I haven't enjoyed writing everything that I've written. I had a novel that was never published that I did 5 drafts of and over a course of 4 years just to learn how to write a novel. But these essays were a lot of fun to write. I took my time with them. I tried to have as much fun as I could with them. And then, you know, the parts that were hard or where things had to be cut or trimmed, I've been writing long enough now that I've just come to accept that. That's just part of the deal.
You're not just a writer. You teach writing at IUPUI. What is it you try to teach your students about writing?
That's a great question. Well, I teach a lot of different writing classes, but the main one that I teach both at the graduate and undergraduate level is creative nonfiction writing. So it's memoir writing. Just my book is a memoir. It's a memoir in essays, I think of it. That's what I teach. One of the things that we really focus on is this idea that when you think about your life, lives aren't lived in months or years or decades, and they're certainly not remembered that way either. Lives are remembered in moments. And one of the first things we do in my class is I ask students to write down 15 moments that they remember from their life. Don't try to interpret them, don't try to say why I'm doing that, but just a moment you remember vividly, write them down. And then later we start working on telling the story of that moment. And so in Headlights of the Prairie, almost all of the essays came out of this exercise. There's an essay in here about a really terrible racetrack wreck that I saw at the Hutchison Fair in 1974. And in the wreck, I saw a man stand up on top of his car and he was on fire and his hands were held out from his side in this kind of Christ-like pose, and then he fell to the ground, and another man or men came and they wrapped the towel around him and put the fire out. That image was just kind of seared into my brain, but the essay is more a telling of the whole story of how that moment came to be. And this is how you find the material that has impacted you the most. And then the real work is, how do you translate that so that it also can have an impact on readers?
Robert, thank you so much for visiting with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Kansas Public Radio has a copy of Headlights on the Prairie, Bad Kansas, and several other Kansas notable books. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, go to our website, kansaspublicradio.org, look under Extras, and then Available Giveaways. You can also leave a comment on KPR's Facebook page under this week's KPR Presents post. Coming up, it's The Great American Read, right after this. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we are 91.5 Lawrence and 90.3 Chanute. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org, where you can listen to many past episodes of KPR Presents. That's at kansaspublicradio.org. Look under News and then KPR Presents. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from the Carlson Center at Johnson County Community College, presenting MoMix in Opus Cactus, where modern dance depicts the American desert Southwest. cactuses, lizards, and insects. September 29th. Details at jccc.edu/Carlson Center. This is KPR. Gone with the Wind? To Kill a Mockingbird? The Great Gatsby? What book would you choose as the great American read? I'm Kay McIntyre, and for the rest of today's KPR Presents, Public Television's Search for America's Best Loved Novel. The Lawrence Public Library is getting into the Great American Read with a series of events co-sponsored by the University of Kansas Libraries and KCPT. Polly Ken is Coordinator of Reader Services at the Lawrence Library. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, you're welcome.
What's the idea behind the Great American Read?
I think the main idea is to get our country talking about reading and having passionate reading conversations. This is something I think that PBS hopes we can all get behind, is what our favorite read is. And that's something that can get everyone talking to each other.
What do you look for in a great read?
For me, I know, you know, there's certain doorways for books. I know my doorway is character a lot. I really have to like the people I'm reading about, or maybe just be interested in them. Occasionally, I'll like a non-likable character. But I really have to love the people I'm spending time with in these stories. And I really love the idea of being transported out of where I'm at to somewhere else. Like, I love it when, you know, I just put the book down and I can't stop thinking about the book. I love those kinds of books. And so I love being transported out of my daily life as a way to sort of get away from things. But then I like when I'm done with a book, if that book took me out of my daily life, like taught me about another culture or taught me about another way of life. Those are my favorite.
One of the surprising aspects of the Great American Read is they're not all American authors. Agatha Christie's on the list, J.K. Rowling, yeah. Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. What was the idea behind opening it up beyond just American authors?
I'm not really sure. I think a lot of it is it's just more of what America is reading, and maybe not not so much that the authors have to be American, but they have definitely impacted how America reads. That's what I think that they were going for.
And how does America read? I mean, like, what kinds of things do we have in common when we're choosing things like the great American novel?
Right. Well, you know, when I'm looking at the list, first of all, and I'm not going to remember this statistic, but I read something not too long ago that said upwards of like 24% of us don't, you know, maybe I think read less than 4 books a year.
I find that hard to believe.
It is, but you know, I mean, I'm very skewed. I work with books all the time. I think you're a book club person. So there's that piece of it. There's maybe a lot of us who aren't reading right now for any particular reason. But looking at this list, I'm noticing it seems like there's a mix of popular reads, like things that are bestsellers, and then classics. And I wondered, when they were polling people, if they got this mix of folks who were currently reading. And so those are the folks who rattled off the bestsellers and folks who haven't read since high school. And those are the folks who were like, what do I remember reading? and could maybe pull out those classics that they remembered reading.
Or to what extent maybe you think, well, great American read, that should be a classic. It shouldn't be just the, mm-hmm. you know, the trashy novel I picked
right.
up. And yet the list goes everywhere from, like I said, I start out with sort of thinking the classics like Moby Dick, mm-hmm. Catcher in the Rye, but it includes things like 50 Shades of Grey and The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, the Twilight series.
The Twilight series.
Yeah. Well, I think, I've noticed, like when you watch the episodes, they named it The Great American Read, but I noticed when they talk about it during the episodes, they're really careful to say more like America's Best Loved Read. And so maybe they realized they were getting some pushback about, what do you mean great? And honestly, you know, great can be whatever, to me as a librarian, great is whatever gets somebody to read and whatever gets somebody engaged in stories and then talking about those stories with other people. So I try really hard to not have a judgment or an opinion about how good the book is. I more try to think about what are the hooks or what are the ways that this book is engaging people. And, you know, sometimes I can look at a book and say, well, that writing might not be the best writing I've ever read, but the story obviously is resonating with people, and the story is obviously catching people in a way that is getting them reading, and that makes me happy, because if they read one book and they like it, then they maybe come look for more, and I can certainly find them more, you know.
Polly, let's get back to the Great American Read. This list of novels, they're novels.
Yes.
The list does not include any nonfiction books. Any thoughts about what's gained or lost by focusing on novels?
I think, I mean, I will say I also read probably as much nonfiction as I read fiction, even though I'm in charge of the fiction department. So I think there are some really great books that we're not asking about or are not presenting to people by not doing nonfiction. But I think the idea perhaps was, you know, to center it on the novel and the story. So I think they probably had to come, they just had to narrow their scope. And I've even had people tell me, I wish they would have only chosen adult novels, because, you know, on here you'll have Charlotte's Web. And how on earth am I going to choose between Charlotte's Web and The Color Purple? Because both of those novels rocked my world, and for very different reasons at very different times in my life. But I guess I'll say the one good thing about this is you don't have to pick just one. You can vote for multiple books many times. You can vote every single day from every device you have, and you can vote for multiple books. So maybe just do that and let the chips fall where they may.
So Polly, I'm going to put you on the spot. What are you voting for on the Great American Novel?
Okay, so I'll tell you the things I have voted for so far. So I voted for The Color Purple is probably...
By Alice Walker
is probably my ultimate book. It, for a while, I was reading it once a year because I just... It was just... I must have picked it up at a time where I needed it, and it impacted me in such a way that I had to keep returning to it. So, and it's just beautiful. And I think it was groundbreaking work at the time when it came out. So, so that book, Outlander, which I loved, which is, by Diana Gabaldon, it's a juggernaut now, but I read it back, 20 years ago or so when I had small kids, and well, at that time I had one small kid, and, I had sort of gotten out, you know, I've been in grad school and then working full time, and I'd just gotten out of the habit of reading for pleasure. And so that book brought pleasure reading back to me.
Some serious escapism. That book's about a little time travel in the Scottish Highlands.
Oh yeah. And Diana leaves, you know, she writes so precisely and writes so much detail that you feel like you are there when you're reading it. And so it was definitely like a little vacation in my mind. And so that book was important to me. Harry Potter has been so important to my children, and then, you know, by extension to me. So I love Harry Potter. The Handmaid's Tale. How could you not vote for The Handmaid's Tale? Beloved also killed me in college when I read that book. You can see, this is like asking me which of my children are my favorite. So those books are have been really important to me. And I'm sure there are some on here. I'm looking at the list. There are some on here that I have loved and are important for other reasons at different times.
I'm visiting with Polly Ken of the Lawrence Public Library. The library is partnering with KU Libraries and KCPT for a series of events tied to the Great American Read. Polly, what have you got planned?
We thought we would screen the episodes. So we did one on September 11th, the kickoff episode. But it's if you saw the one in May, you pretty much saw the same thing. And so and then we will have a series of five that are themed. So PBS has come up with a theme. And then we are pairing that with some KU professors or a local author, actually, who will be after the airing of that episode will, you know, speak to, discuss, facilitate some discussion around that theme. So the first one is will be September 18th at 7 p.m. Who Am I? Led by Darren Kennedy, professor of English at KU. That's at 7 p.m. and it's going to be at the CapFed Business Building at the KU campus, so parking should be real easy. We'll have subsequent Tuesday, September 25th is Heroes, led by Randy Fuller. October 2nd is Villains and Monsters, led by Giselle Anatole and Laura Moriarty. October 9th is What We Do for Love, led by Aisha Hardison. And then October 16th is Other Worlds, led by Bogi Takash, who's an author here in town. And then also, we've done a little reach out to Chris McKittrich, who teaches at KU and does sci-fi. He says he's interested. So hopefully he will be an addition to what we're doing. And so then the big thing is on October 23rd, that is a live episode. Nobody knows what that one is, what's going to happen. We don't know like what's going to be on there. We don't know which book is going to win. But that night is when they sort of they have that last push for voting. And then that's when the last book will be announced.
The big reveal.
And so KCPT is actually coming down and they are going to celebrate with us. They are very excited. Lawrence is right now the top voter in, so they want to come down. They want to party with us because we obviously, you know, have got it going on in the book department. So we're hoping to kind of make it a big thing. You know, we're talking about we'd be wearing bookish costumes. I don't know. I'm taking this as my opportunity to wear a ball gown because never.
So why not?
I really should figure out that, you know, how to wear a ball gown to this thing. Do you, I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you have any predictions about what you think the big winner will be?
Oh my gosh. No, I don't. Mm-hmm. Although I suspect it will be something more on the highbrow end.
It might be. I think To Kill a Mockingbird might take it.
That is a favorite. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone who doesn't love that book.
I know. I think it's a classic that you can feel good about. You know, you can feel like it hasn't dated itself in a way that, you know, is problematic. So that one seems to be, a little bird told me that one is a top vote getter in the region. So I don't know, though. We'll see what happens when it all comes together. I feel like Harry Potter might be a comer, too. I don't know.
It probably depends a lot on the demographics of who's voting, yeah, as it always does in elections.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And if you can get, I mean, so much of this voting is all electronic. And so if you can get all of your, you know, millennials on their phones voting for Harry Potter, well, you're gonna win. So I don't know. That's my two predictions.
Vote early, vote often.
Indeed. Please do.
If people want to find out more about the Great American Read and the Lawrence Public Library's involvement, where can they find out more?
Well, you can go to our website, lplks.org. There should be right smack on the front. You can click on events and see what we're doing in case you don't remember when we're doing these. Every Tuesday, 7 p.m. there they'll be. If you follow us on Facebook or Twitter, we are pushing this out through our social media. So check there too. If you wanted to listen more in depth about this, my colleague Kate and I have the Book Squad podcast, which we do at the library, and we did a whole episode on The Great American Read. Those are the best places to get us. But, you know, you can always just stop by, too, and see us at the desk.
Holly, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Get out there and vote.
Yeah, vote, everyone.
What book would you vote for The Great American Read? I'm Kay McIntyre. I posed that question to some of our KPR staff, starting with Tom Parkinson, host of Morning Edition. Tom, if you had to pick one book for The Great American Read, what would yours be?
That's hard. You know, this list could be like a bucket list of books that actually everyone should read at some time during their life. So it was really hard to choose. But the first book, one of the first books I remember reading, my aunt gave me a children's version of Mark Twain's Adventures of Tom Sawyer. It was, you know, short and children's version. And she inscribed in it to a Tom from Missouri, about a Tom from Missouri, because I was born in Kansas City. And so I read that and I was really intrigued. And a few years later, I was old enough to read the actual book. And I just fell in love with Mark Twain and have read, I guess, all of Mark Twain since then. So it was hard to choose, but I'd have to say that's it. That was my number one.
I'm Jay Schaefer, and if I had to pick a book from this list, I guess it would be Grapes of Wrath. It reminds me of my childhood, growing up on the hard scrabble high plains of West Central Kansas. Oh, wait, no. That wasn't my life. That was the life of my grandparents. Both sets of them, it reminds me of the hardships they faced. But unlike the Jode family of Oklahoma, my Kansas grandparents didn't pull up their stakes and hit the road for sunny, fruit-filled California. Oh no, they stayed behind and worked hard their whole lives. They were made from sturdy peasant stock. It's not that they enjoyed hard times, they just weren't quitters.
I'm Jeff Watson, and I'm most fond of the tales of haunted castles, unquiet crypts, and monstrosities from the depths of perdition. You may therefore surmise my adoration of the elegant prose of the modern Prometheus, known more widely as Frankenstein.
Hi, I'm Laura Lorson, Kansas Public Radio's All Things Considered host, and my very favorite book of all time is Moby Dick by Herman Melville. I think it is just the great American novel. It's kind of about whales, but it's mostly about everything else in the world. I read it initially when I was probably 12 or 13 years old, and I didn't get anything out of it. I read it again when I was about 30, and all of a sudden I just thought, how did I miss out on how wonderful this book was all these years? It's funny, and it's engaging, and it's serious, and it's wonderful, and it just encapsulates the American experience, the world experience, the experience of being human. And it's my favorite book, and I hope you give it a chance too.
And I am Cordelia Brown. I host the classical music in the evenings here on KPR. I call myself a classical friend. And my favorite book is Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. And first of all, I think it's a great book because it's certainly an original story. Often you just read the same old tale told in a different place or time or format, but Wuthering Heights is certainly a tale I had never heard before. It is a bit complicated in trying to keep the people straight in both generations of the story, but anyway, I find it amazing that Emily Bronte, who was supposedly this very sheltered young woman, I think it's amazing that she could write something, well, not only so complex and, well, morally outrageous, it certainly was at the time, but so romantic and so emotionally descriptive. It just, the story, it shows the strange world of dark emotion in a whole family through two generations, and the love between the two main characters, Heathcliff and Catherine, is the type of love that just goes beyond life, literally. And it's just, they're almost vampires in the way that their love just really consumes. The first time I read it, I was convinced that Heathcliff was a villain, that he was bad boy, which he is. But now in my 50s, as I think about the story, you know, I think he was really the hero in villain's clothing. And I don't know, most of all, it's just an incredibly romantic story. Heathcliff desired Catherine in a way that didn't even have thinking. It was just beyond all reason. It was just his feeling. And that comes out so strongly in Wuthering Heights.
What book would I pick? I couldn't decide, so I'm voting more than once. So can you. Go to pbs.org/Great American Read. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.